Blog Talk Radio.
This is the VOCR, the voice of the Canadian Rockets, with your host Colin Knight, aka Guru Nostra, and co-host Hugh Matt.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madame and messieurs, boys and girls, mes enfants. Welcome to another edition of VOCR Radio. I am your host, Colin Knight, aka Guru Nostra, and shotgunning with me tonight is my co-host, Hugh Mack. It's great to be here. Lots to get to tonight, so fill up your glasses, find your favorite seat, crank up the volume, and we'll be right back.
This is the VOCR, the voice of the Canadian Rockets, on the TerraChat Radio Network. On April the 30th, 1945, deep inside a Berlin bunker, the infamous Nazi leader Adolf Hitler took his own life and that of his wife Eva Braun. That piece of history is now being seriously challenged. Recently unearthed evidence comprised of eyewitness accounts and other supporting FBI documents tell a different story. That Hitler did indeed escape the bunker in the final days of the fall of Berlin. According to veteran investigator, journalist, and co-author of Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, Mr. Gerard Williams unearths the truth. The information contained in FBI files and other sources are neither new, nor are they necessarily sensational. But due to some shoddy mainstream journalism and Western government cover-up, many facts are being misinterpreted by mainstream journalists who have suddenly happened upon the story. Tonight's guest, author and film producer Gerard Williams, and the true story of Grey Wolf, The Escape of Hitler, next. Your host, Colin Knight, and co-host, Hugh Mack.
And good evening, everybody. I'm glad you could be here on an unscheduled broadcast. We are broadcasting live on a Saturday morning here in Calgary, Alberta. But we are hitting mainstream market into Europe, I believe, around about 7, 8 p.m. on a Saturday night. Greetings, Hugh. How goes your battle, sir?
It's going about the same. I'm still battling. No.
Well, I tell you, I've been waiting a long time for this show. After seeing the information from Mr. Williams regarding Grey Wolf, I was a little skeptical. So, of course, this week I've gone through every video I can find, and I'm convinced Gerard is right.
I am. I think, yeah, I am too.
I think he's nailed it.
And this is not a completely new theory, like you and I had said before. Is that we've heard this theory as far back as the late 70s and maybe early 80s was when I first heard it. Now it was only a theory, and I don't even remember who was saying it. But not one that I entertained seriously until I heard Gerard Williams speak about it.
Exactly. As I mentioned to you, I believe I heard, the first time I heard of the theory was it Eichmann that they arrested in South America and took him back to Israel? Was it Eichmann? When the Eichmann fiasco was going on, I was pretty young, but deep into politics at that time, and that's when I heard the first hint that there was a secret organization called Odessa, and that they were helping Nazis escape occupied Germany. So anyway, yesterday, yeah, of course, was the 70th anniversary of D-Day, June the 6th, 1944, pivotal invasion of Nazi and occupied France, followed by Eastern assault into Russia. Now, we're going to pick up tonight with Gerard Williams. I'm sure everybody's been beaten to death as to what happened in the Second World War. But tonight we're going to tell you what really happened and how it happened. It's probably going to rattle some walls, but let's take a quick break. Let's set up. As soon as we get back, let's bring Gerard out.
Okay.
Hey,
You are listening to VOCR Radio on the TerraJet Radio Network. Tonight's guest, author and film producer Gerard Williams, and the true story of Grey Wolf, the escape of Hitler.
Unser politischer Auftrag an der Sicherung unseres Lebensraums, Verteidigung unseres deutschen Vaterlandes, Verteidigung unserer nationalsozialistischen Idee. Und wir werden diesen politischen Auftrag unter allen Umständen.
But in the Nazi mind, the boastful Mussolini has crumpled already. He is now but a lackey and a serf, the merest utensil of his master's will.
Gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight, and co-host, Hugh Mack.
And mighty powerful times, Hugh, coming out of the Second World War and 45s and 44, 45. And on the line with us tonight, Gerard Williams, author of Grey Wolf, Escape of Hitler. Good evening, Gerard. Thank you for making it to VOCR.
Good afternoon, Colin. Good afternoon, Hugh. Gentlemen,
good afternoon.
Could I just say thank you to all the Canadians who 70 years ago yesterday landed on the beaches at Normandy. People tend to forget how heavily involved Canadian forces were in the destruction of the Nazi regime. So from one Welshman in France, a great thank you to your nation.
Well, as an expat, now citizen of Canada, and Hugh, who is a Canadian, we do appreciate that very, very much. It was a very difficult
Absolutely.
Time for our country, Newfoundland especially. Newfoundland and Prince Edward Island, their regiments were pretty well decimated. And we will never forget the love for people around the world. And 70 years later, and here we are, we're still fighting what happened. We're still trying to get that... You know, we're still trying to come away from that official story. Now, when I grew up, I heard that April the 28th, Hitler married Eva in the bunker. April the 30th, he orders his body burned after a suicide by gun. And apparently mid-afternoon in April the 30th, Eva commits suicide by a cyanide capsule. Hitler shoots himself. And then somewhere around about May the 1st, May the 2nd, a Hitler lookalike body was found, a couple of charred corpses that they claimed was Hitler and Eva Braun.
Well, that's
so
the
let's
truth,
pick
isn't
it up
it,
from
Gerard?
I'm afraid our research shows that to be complete nonsense. A lie that's been perpetrated on us since 1947 by a British historian called Hugh Trevor Roper, who for unknown reasons was put in by the British government, despite only being qualified as a medieval historian and not a detective, to finally tell us that Adolf Hitler was dead in the way that you have described. Stalin didn't agree with him. He said he'd escaped to Spain or Argentina. Eisenhower said they had no proof at all that Hitler was dead. There were no bodies found that could have been Adolf Hitler or Eva Braun at the bunker. We have a BBC reporter who was embedded with the Soviet troops when they arrived there. For some reason, this story has been perpetuated for over, well, just about 70 years now, but it's distinctly not the truth.
Now, that was Mr. Thomas Cadet that you're speaking of, am I correct?
That's right, very brave man, BBC correspondent in Paris before the war, and a great broadcaster.
We actually have a clip of his broadcast, so I'd like to play that just to set it up to understand exactly what the chaos was like around about that time.
Outside the front door of the shelter are the five perforated petrol tins that were believed to have been used for scattering petrol on the body of Hitler and of burning it. But there, at any rate, my Soviet friends found no trace of Hitler himself. But there was the body of Goebbels, a shot outside the entrance to the shelter. And walking back across the garden and round the ornate lily pond that lies in the middle of it, we came to a spot at the foot of some wooden steps that lead up into this room. They're just 10 feet from me there by the window as I stand. There, at the bottom of those steps, they found the half-burned body of a man with a lock of black hair on the right-hand side of his face and a little black moustache. And they looked at him more closely, and their doctors came to the conclusion that it was what they call a bad double of Hitler and not Hitler himself. If that is so, then all trace of him has disappeared, and only is left behind this indescribable confusion of smashed woodwork, of bullet holes, of shell holes, of dust and rubble and filth, and standing in it these grave, solemn, motionless Soviet officers and guards who now stand guard in this building, which was both the beginning and the end of National Socialism.
So, pretty powerful statement coming from the BBC. Now, that was originally live on one of their broadcasts. And, Gerard, I mean, it's pretty well clear, first-hand report. It just doesn't get any better than that.
Very much so. And, I mean, it's reported in many of the newspapers at the time that Adolf Hitler's body has not been found. There's very little mention of Eva Braun because she was actually not really well known outside of the Mountain People, the people who were closest to Hitler's circle. Marshal Zhukov, who was running Soviet forces in Berlin at the time, said he could have flown away. There was an airfield at his disposal. Major Nikitin, who was with the NKVD, which then became the KGB and now is the FSB, showed a time correspondent the escape tunnel from Hitler's room in the Chancellery, which went all the way down into the underground train system in Berlin. They found a note in the bunker in the middle of that escape tunnel, which looked like it had been written by Eva Braun to her parents to say they wouldn't be hearing from her for some time. We later on have a report from a pilot, which again was reported by the Associated Press, Reuters, UPI, all around the world, who was put on trial in Warsaw in 1947 for being a member of the SS. And at his trial, he gave details of how he flew Hitler, Eva Braun, General Fegelein, and a number of other senior Nazis out from the Hohenzollern-Damm, which is a big, big road in the middle of Berlin, on the morning of the 30th of April. We then have an SS officer on the ground in Tonda in Denmark, which was an airbase controlled by the Nazis at the time, the former Imperial Zeppelin base at Tonda, who describes Hitler being on the ground in Denmark with Eva Braun. They get on another plane from there and fly on to where we believe is Travemünde, where they get a much bigger plane and fly down to Spain. But all this is reported.
And then Franco facilitates the next leg.
Franco then facilitates the next leg, which is down to a Nazi base on the Canary Island of Fuerteventura, where the party are picked up probably a number of days later by three submarines, three U-boats of the last U-boat pack of the war, funnily enough named Seawolf. And 53 days later, after crossing the Atlantic submerged using snorkel technology, they arrive on the coast of Argentina near Necochea.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, if you don't mind, sorry to break in there, but I was as skeptical as hell when I started this. I've been a journalist for 55 years, Reuters, the BBC, my own companies, but I've held pretty senior level posts at both Reuters, Associated Press Television, and the BBC. And I was in Argentina doing documentaries for my own company when I came across this story. And I thought, oh, well, go on, Gerard, for the first time in your life, do a silly conspiracy theory story. I had no idea that 7 years later I'd still be working on it.
And that it was getting deeper and deeper and more fanned out. I'm still not convinced that OSI or British intelligence didn't have some part in this. I can't imagine a man that notorious slipping out and being seen all over the place and going to Argentina without anybody chasing him, especially Wiesenthaler.
Alan Dulles is the key player here on the American side, the OSS operative in Switzerland and Geneva, who later goes on to head up the CIA. Dulles had been friends with Martin Bormann since from before the war. He'd been a corporate lawyer, working with many of the major American companies who invested heavily in Nazi Germany before the war and continued to during the war, which is even more sickening. And a deal was done between what Eisenhower and then Kennedy described as the industrial military complex in America and with the Nazi Party through Martin Bormann to enable America to get hold of incredible technology that puts the U.S. on the moon in the end, along with so many other bits and pieces. And in return, Martin Bormann and Adolf Hitler were allowed to escape to Argentina. They were joined later on by almost 100,000 Nazis and European fascists who escaped with the help of the International for the Red Cross and the Vatican, especially, not necessarily the Catholic Church, but the Vatican, which is the political establishment of the Catholic Church, who helped them get into South America. With them, they took billions, country-buying money, and much of this made its way back into Germany post-war and built what's become, for me, laughingly referred to as the West German economic miracle.
Right. All held by old money, and that kind of ties into where you are, Hugh, regarding the, not the New World Order, but the continuing order of old money.
Well, yeah, as you know, I've said for a long time that I don't think that we ever defeated the Nazis. We might have defeated Germany, but we never defeated the Nazis, and the power structure still exists. Now, it being alive in Argentina, I wasn't aware of a lot of this until I had first heard Gerard a few years ago. What's your take on that, Gerard? I don't think we ever defeated the Nazis. I think most of the Nazi movement got out of Germany. Is that correct?
I think a lot of them got out of Germany, but a lot of them stayed as well, Hugh. There was no serious effort at denazification. And by that stage, people like John J. McCloy, who, along with Alan Dulles, eventually sat on the Warren Commission, McCloy was so friendly to the Nazis, it's disgusting to look at from a historical perspective. I don't know Truman obviously didn't know what was going on because he said that no Nazi would ever work for the American government. Well, they employed thousands of their scientists through Operation Paperclip. I mean, NASA became a Nazi organization. Never mind the intelligence operations that they ran around the world. We have the major involvement of people like the Ford Motor Company in Germany, who built over a third of the trucks that were used by the German military. We have the involvement of IBM, who micromanaged the Holocaust with American operatives actually at the death camps at Dachau and Treblinka. And then we have ITT, we're just taking examples here, who owned 25% of the Focke-Wulf Aircraft Company. The Focke-Wulf Aircraft Company was building fighters to knock down American and British bombers over Europe. And all the profits went back to the state.
As I'd mentioned to you a couple of weeks ago, I read a book called The Arms of Krupp that identifies the Churchill family as major shareholders in blind trust to the German war effort. I mean, it was, then you move into King Edward VIII and the monarchy, who were very sympathetic to the Nazi movement.
Well, Edward VIII definitely was, or is it the seventh, one who abdicated? I'm not too sure about his brother. But, I mean, just as another example, the head of the Reichsbank in Germany during the Nazi period and the head of the Bank of England had been homosexual lovers before the war and continued to meet in Geneva during the war at the International Bank of Settlements. There's a wonderful book by an economist journalist called Adam Labore called The Tower of Babel. I think, which needs to be read. But, I mean, I have no problems about gay relationships at all, but it's just intriguing to me, the head of the Bank of England and the head of the Nazi Central Bank were not just close, but lovers.
In those times, yeah. It's a deep, deep hole when you start talking about wars and who is actually responsible and who is helping who. You know, the old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. There was an argument who we hated the most, Russians or German.
Yeah, there was a complete horror of those godless Soviets, which the Nazis, after the war, used to a wonderful extent to allow Germany to rebuild, while they kept America in complete fear of what was never going to be a major Soviet threat, I don't feel anyway. I think China was much more of a worry in the 40s and 50s than the Soviet Union were. They'd lost so many people. However,
I kind of thought that too, because looking, whenever you saw a video clip of anything Russian, You look around, they would show off their nuclear prowess in their nuclear plants. And you look around, and they were using 1930s telephones. It looked good, but it really was so far out of date that they were of no threat to us. Even their missile carriers, they were really, there was a 50-50 chance they would fire.
Yeah, I think that, this was something that was perpetuated by an organization called the Galen Organization, which became German intelligence post-war. Every single man in that intelligence organization had been either Wehrmacht or SS intelligence. And they worked incredibly closely with OSS and later CIA. And they just fed them nonsense. They fed them nonsense of America, which was incredibly paranoid at the time. I mean, we're talking McCarthyism and everything else, was more than happy to lap up. But, I mean, one thing, I don't do New World Orders or Illuminati or anything like that. I just don't.
Right.
But one thing that does come across to me very clearly is that there is only one motive behind war, and that's so people can make money out of it. I watched Halliburton make Iraq the last time I was there. And I also know that my dad, if he was still alive, God rest his soul, who'd been a combat soldier through World War II, joined up at 18, fought all the way through North Africa, up through Italy, one of the D-Day dodgers, as they were known, wounded three times. If my dad was still alive and he'd read my book, he'd be oiling up his Lee Enfield rifle and going to look for people to shoot.
I think my father would be pretty well the same way listening to this. His blood would be boiling, even though he wouldn't speak of the war very much. He was RAF. He would get very melancholy when the subject was brought up, and he would avoid it at all costs, like many did. But if he got his blood boiling, if he saw something on TV that wound him up regarding the Second World War, then basically everybody get out of his way, let him cool down, because he would literally lose it. Wonderful man, but a lot of ghosts, a lot of deep memories of what he saw and what he was ordered to do and the likes. War is never a good thing to the citizenship.
No, it was only after I'd seen combat myself as a journalist, not as a soldier, that my father thought that he could actually talk to me about it. And I'm the youngest of four.
Right.
He didn't talk to any of the elder ones about it at all. Luckily, they haven't seen what I've seen.
Yeah, I get that. I get that very, very much. I tell you what, guys, let's take a quick break, pause for the course. And when we come back, Gerard, I'd like to get into this this organization, that the method of getting Hitler out of Germany. Okay?
Yep, happy.
All righty, we'll be right back.
Those who would trade our freedom for the soup kitchen of the welfare state have told us they have a utopian solution, a peace without victory. They call their policy accommodation, and they say if we'll only avoid any direct confrontation with the enemy, he'll forget his evil ways and learn to love us. Now let's set the record straight. There's no argument over the choice between peace and war, that the greater risk lies in appeasement. And this is the specter our well-meaning liberal friends refuse to face, that their policy of accommodation is appeasement. And it gives no choice between peace and war, only between fight or surrender.
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make?
No president should fear public scrutiny of his program. For from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people.
Gott lobt politische Soldaten, unser politischer Auftrag lautet Sicherung unseres Lebensraums, Verteidigung unseres deutschen Vaterlandes, Verteidigung unserer nationalsozialistischen Idee, und wir werden diesen politischen Auftrag unter allen Umständen.
We'll be right back.
Information supplied by tonight's guest or host remain the opinion of the speaker and not necessarily the opinion of the TerraChat Network or its affiliates. If you wish to respond to a statement, we invite you to call the show live at 347-324-3287 or email vocr2012@gmail.com. Voice your opinion. Participate in your future. Become engaged in socio-political events. Say your piece.
In Delaware, the largest growth in population is Indian Americans moving from India. You cannot go to a 7-Eleven or a Dunkin' Donuts unless you have a slight Indian accent.
Look, John's last-minute economic plan does nothing to tackle the number one job facing the middle class, and it happens to be, as Barack says, the three-letter word, jobs. J-O-B-S, jobs.
347-324-3287. 347-324-3287.
And we're back with Gerard Williams, author of Grey Wolf, Escape of Adolf Hitler. So, Gerard, for Hitler to have managed to organize this retreat, if you will, or this escape, he would have had to have some kind of communication still intact. How would they organize, and the chaos that Berlin was under, how on earth would they put all of this together to get him and Eva Braun out of the country?
Martin Bormann had been planning for this since 1943, since the defeat at Stalingrad and the later defeat at Kursk, one of the biggest battles of the war, I think the biggest tank battle of the war. He had shifted both physically gold, but mainly through the Swiss banks, who took 6% on each transaction, what would be in terms of billions, into neutral countries, Argentina, Syria and Turkey at the time, Brazil, although that was soon stopped by the Allies, and had set up Argentina as a place waiting for Hitler to come. I'll get back to the Berlin chaos in a second. But Eva Perón and Juan Perón, who later became the president of Argentina, the plot that put them into power, the colonels in 1940, was completely funded by the Nazis. Argentina had its own Nazi party, the only real Nazi party outside of Germany and Austria. If you go and look on YouTube, Nazis in Argentina 1936, you'll see some video that I found of the Argentine Nazis, the German Argentine Nazis, and their huge rallies, 30,000 people in Buenos Aires. Also Argentina, Patagonia, which is more correct, the bottom third of Argentina and Chile, had been effectively a German colony since the 1860s, when Germany lost all its overseas territories at the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War. The winning allies weren't able to take away their territories in Argentina and in Chile because they're both sovereign countries. So they grew, and there were hundreds of thousands of German settlers there, not all of them Nazis, but a considerable number of them who were, just waiting for either the victory of the Reich or for a bell toll for people to go to afterwards. Martin Bormann is key to all this. Although he doesn't appear very much in films like Downfall or anything else, actually, Bormann is head of the Chancellery. Bormann is head of the Nazi Party. He's known amongst the other generals as the Telex General. And he has an incredibly sophisticated, I suppose we would call it a Telex machine now, which links all of Germany throughout the Gauleiters. The Gauleiters were his people, the people who actually ran the civil operation in Germany. But he also had extremely close help with General Müller, Gestapo Müller, who was head of the SS Gestapo in 1945 and in the bunker, and whose body has also never been found. And Müller had a very, very good communication system. And they were able to put into place plans that had been in place for a considerable period of time. You don't dig an escape tunnel overnight. It has to be built over a period of time.
True.
You don't arrange for I think by the time the 29th, 30th came around, a lot of their options were closing down because the Soviets are right there. They're on the doorstep.
Right.
But before that, they managed to get a lot of people out of Berlin, either by flying them out or by driving them out through corridors that were still in existence. And you have to remember that although the Germans look like they're losing everywhere, in places like Denmark, they've still got 300,000 armed troops.
Right.
You know, in various places, in Italy and Austria and various other nations, they're still solidly ensconced. They are falling back on the Eastern Front, and Patton and Montgomery are kicking their butts in Europe at huge cost to the Allies. But they still have active aircraft. They still have active submarines. They're running a 9-boat Grey Wolf U-boat pack into the Atlantic in the last days of the war. And they told America that they're about to fire V weapons from these submarines against the eastern seaboard. And if you go back and look at people like Mayor LaGuardia of New York at the time and the head of the Home Defense, an admiral whose name escapes me, you will see that this panic was taken very, very seriously in the American press. It was a threat made by Albert Speer that they were going to fire V weapons at the American coast, and the Americans were concerned. They'd have chemical weapons in them. There was also a great concern that the Germans had developed a nuclear weapon at this stage of the war, something which, again, is not talked about at all. But my research leads me to think that they had at least battlefield weapons of some sort. And they sent this U-boat pack into the Atlantic to draw American naval forces northward so that the escape route across the southern Atlantic wouldn't have any American ships looking for submarines down there. And that's when these three U-boats broke off and headed for the Canaries to pick up these high-ranking Nazis, including Adolf and Eva. Oh, by the way, I don't believe they ever wed in the bunker. My research leads me to believe that they wed in Argentina late in 1945, just before Eva Braun gave birth to their second daughter.
Oh, wow.
So, there you go. It all sounds ridiculous, gentlemen, I know. But,
At the surface, Gerard, you can, you know, it's any conspiracy, who killed JFK, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at the surface, it tantamounts to impossible to resolve. But when you start looking at the pieces putting together that you have done, you start putting that together.
People like the DNA expert, Martin Bernanke, who went to Moscow to FSB headquarters, and was able to DNA test the fragmented skull that the Russians have always said was Adolf Hitler's. And the DNA testing proved that fragmented skull with the bullet hole through it, which anybody can find by looking on the internet, is actually that of a woman in her 40s. So it can't even be Eva Braun's skull. There is no evidence to his death in the bunker. And there are huge amounts of evidence post-war to his survival.
Even the stuff that the Russians have, they claim to have his couch and a piece of skull, and they've proven that all of that has got absolutely nothing to do with Hitler or Eva Braun. And I know Hugh has got a whack of questions, so I'm going to turn this over to Hugh for a few minutes. And Hugh, if you'd like to hammer your questions away at Gerard, this is fascinating, guys. I mean, this information is sitting right into the gaps of history that I think we need to know. So, Hugh, have at it.
So I want to just carry on with how did this the official line get propagated to the point where everybody bought into it? Even that clip that we did right after the war, there, the guy walking around in the bunker saying that it was just a poor copy of Adolf Hitler. So how did this become the mainstream story that Hitler died in the bunker?
You know, Hugh, I'm at a complete loss to know. It has been bothering me a great deal because there are so many people who say, while the Trevor Roper report is published and made into one of the best-selling books ever, for instance, von Bülow, who was the Luftwaffe adjutant with Hitler in the bunker, said that every time he read or was referred to in the Trevor Roper book, he laughed. Trevor Roper said he'd interviewed Hannah Reich, who's one of the most famous female pilots of the 20th century, who was a close friend of Hitler, flew in at the end of the war with her boyfriend who was head of the Luftwaffe and then managed to fly out again, but not with Hitler. Hannah Reich said she had never met Trevor Roper, and Trevor Roper, we now know, only had access to limited American intelligence and interrogation reports from Hannah Reich. He quotes, I can't remember if it's Gunscher or Linger, who are two of the people who are always quoted. I think it's Gunscher, as saying that he took the bodies upstairs, that they poured petrol over them, and they incinerated them. Well, physics tells us that you simply can't burn a human body by pouring petrol over it. It has to be incinerated in crematoria for it to work. But Gunscher was on the BBC in 1954 when he was released by the Soviets, and he said that as far as he knew, Hitler's body had been buried in a mass grave. Now, I have the videotape of this guy from the BBC in Town Tonight, broadcast live at the time. So that's another supposed report that isn't true. Gunscher didn't know what had happened to Hitler's body. He just said he thinks he was buried in a mass grave in Berlin. Rockus Mitch, who's always described as, you know, Hitler's bodyguard, he died last year, changed his mind and changed his story on three separate occasions. He heard the shot, he didn't hear the shot. He saw the bodies, he never saw the bodies. The man was a corporal working on the telephone system in the bunker. How close do you think he got to the leader of Germany? Not very close is the answer to that.
So it sounds to me like the big culprit here in perpetuating the story is basically the mainstream media. They just didn't do any investigation. They took suggestions and vague theories and ran with it. Is that the way it happened, do you think?
Possibly. I mean, it's quite interesting that, you know, there are lots of reports in American newspapers after the war, and anybody can go and look through these things online now, from people who were I think one of the major translators of the Nuremberg War Trials, said that he believed Hitler had escaped to Argentina. He was an American officer. And there's lots of these little stories that appear in American and British newspapers and French and Italian newspapers after the war. So it's also people like Reuters are interviewing Eisenhower, and Eisenhower in 1952 says, "We have no proof that Adolf Hitler is dead. We think he is, but we have no proof that he is dead." And, you know, again, that's a direct quote from the former senior commander in Europe at the time. For some reason, I think that, and I hate to say this because my co-author, Simon Dunstan, who is an incredible man and a military historian, but I think historians are lazy. And they have simply been given the Hugh Trevor Roper book and accept him as an unimpeachable source and quote him. And this quote gets completely, you know, repeated and repeated and repeated. I can't remember if it was Goebbels or Hitler who said, if you tell a lie often enough and loud enough, it becomes the truth. But it very often does. And it was only in the 70s when Trevor Roper then decided that the Hitler Diaries, which, you know, some of your listeners may remember, published by the Sunday Times and one of the major German newspapers, were real. These were things written in biro on paper that didn't exist until 1954. But Trevor Roper said they were real, and, of course, that was the end of his reputation. But nobody's gone back and looked at the contemporaneous reporting, and the contemporaneous reporting not just in Europe, but also in Argentina as well. And we've been very fortunate. I've been to Argentina 15 times. Wonderful country, beautiful people. But people must not think of it as being sort of like the Brazilian jungle. It looks like Bavaria. I'm sure parts of it wouldn't be out of place in the Rockies. And it's very, very German in places, extremely German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it seems like what you said there was historians just tend to build on other historians' work rather than starting from scratch with a new theory or a new hypothesis. They just seem to have built on what somebody else had said and gone with it. And it's kind of perpetuated.
I've been a journalist since I was 19. I've done it the hard way. And, you know, covered most of the major conflicts of the 20th century, fall of the Soviet Union, Rwanda, 2.5 years covering the Yugoslav breakup, the Bosnian War, Iraq twice. I've been around. I've done my stories. And I like to deal in facts. I know journalism doesn't have a great reputation anymore, but, you know, I'm one of the old school. And when you find out a story and you realize that what you've been told isn't true, it's my job, although I'm not getting paid for it terribly well, But it's inside me. I need to be able to tell people what I have discovered. The book's subtitle is The Case Presented, and it's up to anybody who reads Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, to decide if they think the case has been presented enough. We have more information now, and I'm hoping, and Simon and I are both hoping, that we'll find a publisher to pick up our second book. And that has a huge amount more information both about Hitler and about Bormann and the organization that was set up before the end of the war and what it did after the war.
My gut instinct tells me, Gerard, that you're not going to have a problem finding a publisher to pick up the second book. After reading the first one.
You'd be very surprised. The publishers of our first book, their legal team decided that they would not publish our second book in case the Vatican became too upset. They were worried that mobs of rampaging Catholics would burn down Barnes and Noble bookstores in America. and they wanted us to take out $1 million insurance on it. Well, so they didn't pay us $1 million for the first one. We're going to do it. We'll find a decent...
Gerard, let me... You know, in America, it's a very strange market, but I dare say if they didn't burn down Barnes & Noble for carrying G.W. Bush, his autobiography, I think you're pretty safe, you know.
Yeah, but I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
Well, there you go. Don't get me started. You know, looking at this whole Grey Wolf and Hitler's escape and...
You seem to have had a problem on the line, gentlemen.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I can now. We went very fuzzy, and then you're back.
Okay, we just got a thing up that says there is a problem. And Colin, we lost Colin here, so I'm not sure what's going on. Anyways, supposedly Hitler got out. He took the submarines took him to Argentina, and he was living, according to some, in a mansion that was built for him. And I believe you quoted the architect or referred to the architect that had built the place. Is that right?
Yes, Alexander Bustillo, the house that was built at the far end of Lake Nahuel Huapi, quite a long way from Bariloche, their nearest big town, was called Inalco. Part of a whole operation that was known as Hitler's Valley in Argentina at the time, run by a senior SS officer who we believe would probably be B.B. van Elbensleben, who also escaped to Argentina and later, in the late 50s, early 60s, became the fisheries minister under Perón. An SS general running fishing in Argentina, which sort of shows you how close they were.
Right, yeah.
Sorry about that, guys. I fell down, go boom, but I'm back. So,
welcome back.
Thanks. So, as I was talking about the intelligence services, where were we? Do you think British intelligence and OSI really knew what was going on, or were they following the same drum call of mistakes?
I think British intelligence post-war is incredibly busy with the collapse of empire. They've been told Hitler's dead. They haven't got time to go chasing Nazis. They do a little bit of it in Germany, but they don't do any of it internationally.
Right.
The thing is, he's dead. I mean, that's the whole point. You know, he's dead. Everybody's been told he's dead. You know, there's no point in searching for a dead man. I mean, what's interesting is that Martin Bormann, who also the Germans said they found his body, DNA tested, and it was definitely Bormann. He died in 1945. The West German government, and now the German government, refused, and I've asked them on numerous occasions, to name the relative that this convincing DNA test came from. It meant to be an 83-year-old female relative, Martin Bormann, who none of his surviving children had ever heard of. The same as with Gestapo Müller. They found his grave in the 1960s and exhumed it. And there were three different types of bits of body in it, none of which could have been Müller. I know Müller was in Argentina anyway, running security. So that didn't surprise me when I found that piece of paper, when I found that report. Sorry, gentlemen, I got a little off track there, but
That's fine. I get how deep it is, Gerard, and that's half of the ability of the intelligence services to make sure the truth is difficult to find. I think there's so much truth out there and so much BS that it's like the UFO conspiracy. You know?
Very often,
just like the UFO conspiracy.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily know anything about UFOs, but the DS does cover up the real information very effectively. And what's interesting to me is that Hoover of the FBI doesn't seem to have accepted. They're having a real sort of head-to-head with OSS and what later became CIA, as Hoover, the FBI was handling most foreign intelligence gathering before CIA was born under Allen Dulles. And Hoover doesn't seem to believe that Hitler was dead. He's got people looking for him in Argentina. He's taking every single report of a sighting of Hitler and Eva Braun very, very seriously. That falls off later, but Hitler's dead in 1962 anyway, on February the 6th at 3 p.m. in the afternoon, attended by his personal physician, Dr. Otto Lehmann, and details of that are in the book.
Wow. Wow. I shake my head because, I kind of put the analogy together. It's like the Boeing 777 that went missing out of Malaysia. You know, it's a head scratcher.
But
the truth is so buried in garbage, you know?
I think we can get a little closer where we actually know that what was told to us was garbage, and that's weapons of mass destruction before Iraq II. There were no weapons of mass destruction. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis are dead. Hundreds of thousands, well, not hundreds of thousands, but tens of thousands of American, British, and other allied soldiers are dead, all because we thought we were told that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, which he didn't. At the end of the war, when everybody's tired and they want the Nazis to have gone away, they're scared of the Soviets, the British Empire is collapsing, mainly under American pressure to make it do so, not that I'm a big imperialist or anything. And Israel is surrounded, the baby state of Israel is surrounded by enemies on all sides. People haven't got the time to go looking for Nazis. The Eichmann chapter, which... there's a very different real story behind the Eichmann capture than the one that Mossad put out. In fact, Mossad had their version of it on their website for years and years and years until a very brave Argentine journalist broke the real story. It's not worth going into here, but, it's not. We're told lies all the time. We're told lies every day by our governments.
Right.
Sometimes maybe that's necessary. Right. I don't know. I'm not a politician. I'm a journalist.
So as you dig into this story regarding Hitler, did you get much resistance from official offices of the various governments?
No, the Argentine government were actually quite helpful to us under the former President Kirchner, and we met with them on a number of occasions, as was the Soviet ambassador, or the Russian ambassador, I hasten to add, in Argentina at the time. Two of our witnesses did have death threats made against them, and they were told to stop talking to us about the Hitler in Argentina story, or one of them was told that their house would be burned down, their children would be killed, and another one was told that the Gestapo was still active, and that it was very dangerous for her to continue talking to us as Eva Braun was still alive, which is back in the early 2000s. You have to remember she was only 26 when she went to Argentina. She was a very young woman.
Right. So she'd be in her early 80s now if she was still alive.
She's dead now, but she would have lived, a similar age to our own Queen Elizabeth, I suppose. Who also, in her late teens, early 20s at the end of the war. So, she's looking pretty good, but all that money helps. And we're not talking about Ava Brown being impoverished. Yeah, it doesn't hurt at all.
Yeah. So what happened to, I read a story years and years ago that the Nazi gold was transferred to Fort Knox.
I think very possibly quite a lot of the gold that was found in Germany at the end of the war ended up in American hands. And you have to understand that, you know, that was probably an extremely good reason for it. You'd spent a fortune trying to free Europe from, or liberate Europe from Nazi aggression. A lot of the physical gold, which went out to Argentina, you only have to look at the details of Argentina's gold reserves in the period, went out to Spain and Portugal, while Germany still had control of France. And remember, that wasn't until June 1944 when they began to lose control a little bit. But most of it was simply done by international transfer. Gold or whatever would be shipped into Switzerland. The Swiss would say, thank you very much, melt it down, put it out as something else, and send a letter of credit to a bank in Argentina. Very simple.
And the
700 front companies in around the world to enable this to happen. I mean, companies which today are major infrastructure companies like Siemens, for example, Siemens was described by MI6, the International Service of British Intelligence, before the war, as the international arm of the SS. And I hope you guys aren't wearing Hugo Boss, because Hugo Boss designed the SS uniforms. And it amazes me that a brand like that could still be active and incredibly successful today.
Well, it frustrates me when I do see that many of the collaborators of the Nazi era still exist and are flourishing. I was shocked to realize that Eichmann had a family business that was still paying him dividends on a monthly basis.
Sorry, Colin, to go into that, but it was Mengele. They were one of the largest farming manufacturers. And they were paying him money while he was running South America.
I mean, absolutely amazing, you know, that our intelligence services didn't see that. I'm sorry. Even back then in the paper trail days, there is no way that these people could continue existing without them knowing.
I'm sure they did. But with Alan Dulles at the head of the CIA and his partner in crime, John J. McCloy, running Germany, a lot of these reports were simply stamped out, you know, thrown away. It's interesting there was a huge fire in the paper archives of the American government about 7 years ago, where almost that whole period has disappeared on paper. And the FBI material that was released over 10 years ago, and there's a lot of rubbish on the net at the moment saying, new files released from the FBI prove Adolf Hitler escaped to Argentina. There's nothing new about these files. All the relevant ones are in Grey Wolf. And we were looking at that material, well, I know other people were looking at that material at least 10 years ago. But they have been redacted so badly, in fact, you know, somebody's gone over with them with a felt tip marker, that it's impossible to track down the names of the claimants and everything else. There's still some pretty hefty information contained in them, but they aren't the smoking gun. They aren't the proof positive that Hitler made it out. It's not just Hitler. I mean, Hitler's sort of the sexy top line, if you can describe such a horrible creature as the sexy top line in the story. It's what else went on, and it's the involvement, you know, of international capital in it all. It makes me pretty sick. Henry Ford was a great American hero, but, you know, he was one of the worst anti-Semites ever. I mean, Hitler gave the highest civilian honor to the Nazi.
Yeah, I was shocked recently with Der Spiegel. They sent out a piece that Nazi veterans created an illegal army. And it says, newly discovered documents show that the years after World War II, former members of the Nazi Wehrmacht and Waffen-SS formed a secret army to protect the country from the Soviets. Now, this is just coming out.
Yeah, but I mean, the BND, the German intelligence organization, knew about this for years because they were part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, at one stage in the 1950s and 60s, if you wanted to become a German equivalent of the CIA, FBI, your father had to have been a member of the original Galen organization. So you have to come from a good Aryan Nazi family. So the people who went on to run the spy system in Germany, probably up until the present day, because their children would be my age, 55 now, are all the sons of confirmed oath-swearing Nazis.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying Germany today is a Nazi country. I have a lot of time, a lot of German friends as well. But the basics for that nation state and its economic superiority in Europe and in, around the world are very firmly based in the Nazis. Very firmly based.
Yeah. Yeah. One more question before we let Gerard go here?
Please.
I was reading somewhere the other day that Hitler's birth father was it an outlaw or perhaps I can't remember anyways, but there was something shady about him, but no mention of anybody in Hitler's family being a Nazi or prior to him.
No, but as far as I remember, Alba Hitler was a postman. I don't know whether he was Hitler's birth father. I must admit, my Hitler interest is pretty much from 1945 on, which may sound obscure. I have done, sort of basic teenage history about the Second World War, and I've always been surrounded by it in many ways. In Europe, you can't help but be surrounded by it. But I'm unsure about that, to be honest with you.
It would be very interesting, to catch up with Hitler's children, and find out what their life was and what they knew and didn't know, and if they have any memorabilia of the Hitler war years. Has anybody made an attempt at identifying them?
We came across various signs of them during our research, but very early on, I decided that wasn't really my job to go around chasing the kids of the people who did these terrible things. If they wanted to come out and talk to me, I'd be more than happy to listen. But it's not my job to chase down the children of depraved monsters.
Makes sense.
Other people think I should, but I'm sorry, that's not my view of morality.
Exactly.
And I think one thing is interesting before we finish. Yeah. Is that
absolutely.
Adolf Hitler was the only person who was not charged with a single crime at Nuremberg. And they weren't convinced...
Not even in absentia.
No, Martin Bormann was charged in absentia, and he was found guilty of crimes against humanity. But Adolf Hitler, despite the fact they had no forensic evidence that his body had been found and that the Soviets believed he had escaped, was never charged with anything. And I think that's part of the deal.
Yeah, well, you might be right at that, Gerard Williams. Grey Wolf, Escape of Hitler, where can it be found?
It can be found on Amazon Canada, where it has been doing quite well. Also available on other Barnes & Noble sites and hopefully in good bookshops throughout Canada. My apologies to our French-speaking friends that it isn't available in French at the moment. We are discussing that with a Canadian publisher currently. Also, the film, there's a docudrama that accompanies the book, which is the Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, which is just in the next couple of months will be being distributed in the United States and separately in Canada. So I hope people get a chance to see that as well. And if they want any more information, they can contact me directly at greywolfmedia.com. I'm more than happy to try and answer anybody's questions if they've actually read the book, but more than happy to try and involve myself.
Brilliant. Thank you, Gerard. We appreciate your time, sir, and enjoy that beautiful French evening.
Thank you, gentlemen. I will. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
I appreciate it, Gerard.
Thank you
very much.
Good night, sir.
Good night.
Well, fantastic. Fantastic. Absolutely amazing information there, Hugh. I get the feeling
we could have gone
right
on for
the
hours.
Top. Yeah.
I
think we could, and I'm hopefully we can pick his brains on this book, too. It fascinates me.
Yeah, I'd sure like to talk to him again and carry on.
We'll see what we can do. Hugh, been a pleasure. We'll catch you on Tuesday night, and we'll review what we've heard tonight.
Fantastic. Sounds good.
Talk to you soon.
Gentlemen, we all have busy lives, and sometimes we forget the small things in life that make many people happy. We work hard, and we earn a great deal of money, or we hope to, and we spend a great deal of money. And yet there are those in our world who have no money to spend. There are those in this world that are fighting for survival as we speak. Give a moment to think of those people. Do what you can as a good human being. Do what you can to help their world be a little brighter. Good night, and we'll catch you back here on the next edition of VOCR Radio. This has been a TerrorChat Network production.